Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and I want to issue my first ever content warning, comrades and friends. This is something I should have done last week. It's something I should have done on numerous occasions before, because many of the things that get mentioned on this show are pretty heavy and potentially triggering for members of the audience. And I don't want anyone to be in a situation that's too much for them. So I'm going to warn you right now that this episode of the show is going to be dealing with residential schools and the genocide of Indigenous peoples in Canada. If you're not comfortable getting into that right now, please take the time to care for yourself. Now, September 30th, 2021 was the first ever National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. This was made into a federal statutory holiday in Canada. Although we didn't get any time off here in Ontario because Ontario is one of several provinces which refused to recognize the holiday, which in itself says a lot. September 30th was being marked as Orange Shirt Day since 2013. It's nothing new by Indigenous peoples in this country seeking to honor the survivors of residential schools and to commemorate those victims of residential schools who never came home. In particular, it centers around the story of Phyllis Webstad, whose firsthand story I'm going to read for you right now. I went to the mission for one school year in 1973-1974. I had just turned 6 years old. I lived with my grandmother on the Dog Creek Reserve. We never had much money, but somehow my granny managed to buy me a new outfit to go to the mission school. I remember going to Robinson's store and picking out a shiny orange shirt. It had string laced up in front and was so bright and exciting, just like I felt to be going to school. When I got to the mission, they stripped me and took away my clothes, including the orange shirt. I never wore it again. I didn't understand why they wouldn't give it back to me. It was mine. The color orange has always reminded me of that and how my feelings didn't matter, how no one cared, and how I felt like I was worth nothing. All of us little children were crying and no one cared. I was 13 years old and in grade 8 when my son Jeremy was born. Because my grandmother and mother both attended residential school for 10 years each, I never knew what a parent was supposed to be like. With the help of my aunt, Agnes Jack, I was able to raise my son and have him know me as his mother. I went to a treatment center for healing when I was 27 and have been on this healing journey since then. I finally get it, that the feeling of worthlessness and insignificance ingrained in me from my first day at the mission affected the way I lived my life for many years. Even now, when I know nothing could be further from the truth, I still sometimes feel that I don't matter, even with all the work I've done. I am honored to be able to tell my story so that others may benefit and understand, and maybe other survivors will feel comfortable enough to share their stories. So that was Phyllis's story. And I'm going to put a link on the blog so you can read more about Phyllis and her background. So that's the background of Orange Shirt Day, why an orange shirt in particular became the symbol of this movement. You know, concerning securing justice for and healing for the survivors of residential schools. Now, the Canadian government chose to make Orange Shirt Day into a federal holiday this year. I think it was in June they decided to make that move. And I went to one of the ceremonies that was held here in Guelph at the Sacred Fire in Royal City Park. And I listened to the elders, observed the ceremony and the drumming, inhaled the smoke from the Sacred Fire, and personally confronted our MP, Lloyd Longfield, once more about the water crisis on reservations. And, you know, something which I did during the election campaign as well. And generally, I did what I could under the circumstances. There were a lot of settlers there. There was a lot of clapping, a lot of talk about reconciliation. And I was reminded of a quote by the African revolutionary Amilcar Cabral, you know, who led the revolutionary struggle against Portuguese colonialism in Cape Verde and Guinea-Bissau in West Africa. And Amilcar Cabral was a staunch revolutionary, a Marxist-Leninist, and this very famous quote, he exhorted his fellow revolutionaries to, quote, claim no easy victories. Claim no easy victories. And I was reminded of that. It was because it felt all too easy for settlers like myself to go to a ceremony like this, to watch the drumming, inhale the smoke, and feel righteous for simply caring. You know, and kind of doing this whole, you know, engaging in this whole performance, you know, one day a year performance in honor of residential school survivors. you know, there was a lot of high-handed rhetoric coming from public officials on September 30th. You know, there was talk about moving forward and rebuilding trust and just tons and tons of stuff about reconciliation between Indigenous people and the settler colonial state, which continues to kill them. You know, let's be clear on that. Like, whether we're talking about, like, continued land theft, you know, the theft of children from their parents, from their communities, and putting them in the foster care system where, like, you know, like, massive, disproportionate numbers, especially in Western Canada, of the kids who are caught up in that system are Indigenous. You know, once again, stolen away from their parents, stolen away from their communities, you know, just like they were during the days of the residential schools, which once again only ended in 1996. So the very recent past. You know, and then of course there's, you know, police brutality, the prison system, you know, which of course disproportionately locks up a massive number of Indigenous people. You know, they get imprisoned, you know, completely disproportionate to their numbers. You know, and yet there's all this talk about reconciliation with the settler colonial state, which continues to oppress Indigenous people. As someone who participated in the Wet'suwet'en protests in early 2020, you know, in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en people in BC as they were standing up against a pipeline construction on their land, on their unceded land. And this, of course, was just before the pandemic hit. You know, it was truly surreal, you know, being, you know, the atmosphere on the 30th, it was truly surreal for me as someone who participated in those protests. I mean, everyone back then was saying that reconciliation was dead. And yet here suddenly it's back on everyone's lips as though a new federal holiday could substitute for actual concrete policy change, of which there's been practically nothing. Right? There's been no change since then. There's been no justice since then. That struggle goes on. On the Wet'suwet'en land, they're still fighting to defend their land. They're still fighting against those man camps and those pipeline builders and all these guys who want to, like, just bulldoze their rights and just trample on their ways and trample on their culture and trample on their land and everything they stand for. This is what the Wet'suwet'en Checkpoint Instagram account had to say on September 30th. Quote, "Reconciliation is nothing more than a catchphrase to the colonial government. And this day comes across as nothing more than a pacification. This day comes across as nothing more than a pacification," end quote. Indeed, it's notable that Justin Trudeau chose to go on vacation that day in Tofino on Vancouver Island rather than accept an invitation by an Indigenous nation to honor the memory of the 215 children recovered from the former residential school in Kamloops. And as of now, the remains of more than 6,000 children have been unearthed on the sites of former residential schools. Just driving home the point, which I made on an episode of the show earlier this year, that this is not simply a cultural genocide. This was not simply an attempt to wipe out Indigenous culture. This was an attempt to basically destroy Indigenous people as people, you know, as nations. You know, this took away their lives. This is genocide in the fullest sense of the word. You know, and as more and more bodies get unearthed, I mean, it's just undeniable. And with this in mind, it's really hard not to view this new holiday as a PR stunt by the Canadian government. They were really on the back foot after the Wet'suwet'en protests, and now they're trying to rehabilitate themselves and reclaim some of the legitimacy they lost amidst all the RCMP crackdowns and mass arrests and all that took place back then, you know, in the public eye. And, of course, you know, those crackdowns are still taking place. I mean, they're taking place at Ferry Creek and other sites around the country as, like, land defenders continue to face repression along with their allies. You know, the Canadian government wanted to put reconciliation back on everyone's lips and make it seem like they care, despite having done nothing to alleviate the suffering of oppressed Indigenous communities. You know, I mean, there's still boiled water, advisories on a lot of reserves. That has not been solved. You know, and once again, and land is still being stolen. You know, these kind of pipeline projects are still being built. You know, the crackdowns are still ongoing. And indigenous children are still being stolen away from their communities. You know, by the government, by government authorities. So as I took part in this event at Rural City Park, I couldn't help but think of, you know, another thing I was kind of reminded of was the word catharsis, which is an ancient Greek word. And the reason why I thought of that is because the entire event could have been framed as a way to blow off steam, almost. Which catharsis kind of is. It's kind of like just letting it all out, you know. You know, as a way of venting emotion. You know, the event was kind of like a means to vent emotion before effectively returning to normal. And Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher and, you know, arch misogynist and apologist for slavery, you know, he just sucked all around, if you ask me. Aristotle talked approvingly about tragic dramas in his writings. You know, he talked about tragedy. You know, as, you know, tragic dramas, tragic plays. You know, the kind of plays that were put on once per year in this, you know, it was almost like the ancient equivalent of a film festival in the Athenian amphitheater, you know, in ancient Athens. And Aristotle described how these productions, they allowed men in particular to let their pent-up emotions go. Just, you know, let their emotions go so they could be cool-headed and rational for the rest of the year. And of course, you know, in ancient Greece, you know, if you were a man, you weren't supposed to show emotion. You were supposed to be like cool-headed. You were supposed to be rational, like, you know, governed by reason, all that kind of thing. And that was kind of like the, you know, how you were supposed to be, right? So this was kind of like the way Aristotle kind of portrayed this is like, okay, you go to, like, a man, he goes to the this play, this tragedy, lets his emotions go, cries, does all the things he needs to do, then he can come out and be a man again, quote unquote. You know, it was like a social safety valve. You know, he could let out the anger, he could let out the let out the fear, let out like the sadness, anything he was feeling, right? That it was a social safety valve, and therefore he wouldn't be you know, flying off the handle at any time the rest of the year. You know, you just let it go. And so, and like with regard to the truth and reconciliation ceremonies on September 30th, you know, not only settlers, but indigenous people as well, including residential school survivors, were given an official outlet for their grief, which Trudeau and his government hopes can be kept contained and manageable. They don't want like a repeat of the Wet'suwet'en protests. They don't want people in the streets getting angry, you know, potentially like, you know, standing up to the cops and all this sort of stuff. They don't want that. You know, they certainly don't want that. And they want, you know, indigenous people to be kept under control and their allies to be kept under control. And this is one way they're going to do it. By giving people this opportunity to blow off steam in an official capacity, like in an official holiday. And another thing, a third thing here, that the ceremony reminded me of was Edmund Burke's political ideology of reconciliation. You know, reconciliation as a political concept. You know, after all, I did a major in political science. It's mostly a useless degree, but nonetheless, it like did introduce me to some interesting concepts like this, which actually are kind of, you know, illustrative at a time like this. I mean, Burke was the 18th century founder of modern conservative politics. And he sought to, one of the big things he talked about in his writings was the idea of like trying to reconcile the masses of working class and oppressed people to the system that was oppressing them by invoking the idea of a shared history and a supposedly harmonious past, where everybody got along and knew their place, and that this vision of a harmonious past was going to legitimize the system in everybody's eyes, make it seem organic and natural and all that. You know, it's an inherently reactionary idea. But Trudeau is basically pushing the same thing here today. Reconciliation, once again, is a political concept. I mean, reconciliation between individual people is a completely different thing. But reconciliation as a political concept implies that there was a time when settlers and indigenous peoples lived together in peace, and that this time can be returned to somehow. It can be returned to somehow. And this is nonsense. As some commentators pointed out on September 30th, settler interactions with indigenous nations in this part of the world were always characterized by colonial violence. You know, going back to the 15th, 16th century and culminating in the genocidal violence of the residential school system and other violent attempts to eradicate indigenous culture and communities entirely. You know, yeah, genocide. There is no promised land to go back to or to rebuild. Like any justice that we can forge in the present context will be in the context of a new system, like building a new system that allows justice to be created on this land, really for the first time since colonialism began. And dismantling colonialism in Canada will be very hard. Even though we've seen settler colonial regimes fall in the past and be dismantled, they've been very different from the modern Canadian context. I mean, apartheid South Africa was propped up by a hyper-militarized settler minority, you know, a white settler minority that used brutal violence to suppress the indigenous masses of black South Africans, you know, outnumbered them by a massive margin, you know, like, you know, you had like tens of millions of like black South Africans in like a, you know, relatively small number. There were still like, you know, more than a million, like a couple of million white South Africans. But, you know, like the indigenous population completely outnumbered the settler population. And it was the same in colonial Algeria in the 1950s. I mean, Algeria in the 1950s was actually treated as an extension of France, despite being in Africa. And it had a white minority population numbering in the millions. You know, these settler, you know, white settlers who came from France settled in Algeria. And yet the indigenous population there still outnumbered that settler population many times over. And the indigenous population was able to fight for independence. It was long and bloody conflict. Hundreds of thousands of people died. But they still were able to win independence for themselves. And basically, most of those settlers, after independence was won, basically left the country, went back to France. In Canada, the indigenous population is a small minority, surrounded by great masses of settlers. And no country like this, you know, Canada isn't the only country like this. I mean, you have Australia, you have New Zealand, and the United States as well. No country like this has ever successfully decolonized. I mean, the genocide here was so bad that it reduced indigenous people to minority status on their own land. You know, in terms of decolonization, we're in uncharted territory here. Settlers are going to have to be a part of the solution. They're going to have to be a part of any anti-colonial liberation struggle. But for that to happen, settlers are going to have to want something better for themselves. They can't just want to keep the status quo. You know, and you cannot build a revolution on altruism. You know, like you have like a bunch of settlers who feel sorry for the indigenous population, so they want to make a revolution. It doesn't work that way. You know, there's never been a revolution built on altruism. Like there has to be a certain amount of self-interest, and many struggles from labor to the environment, you know, these things which impact so many people around this country. All those struggles are going to have to be combined in the struggle for indigenous liberation if justice is to be done and colonialism finally overthrown on occupied Turtle Island. Now, in this year's federal election, the Communist Party of Canada campaigned on what it calls a new equal and voluntary partnership that would recognize the right of nations within Canada, you know, specifically indigenous nations, to self-determination up to and including the right to secession, the right to leave Canada if they want, and also saying that there needs to be a new constitution based on an equal voluntary partnership of Indigenous nations, Quebec, Acadians, and English-speaking Canada. You know, that is essential if justice is to be done, you know, on this land. You know, And this, of course, was in addition to ensuring a just settlement of indigenous land claims, respecting indigenous rights under the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, UNDRIP, you know, their rights to veto pipelines and development on or near their lands, as well as enacting the calls to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And this was the only electoral platform that I saw that really challenged the foundations of colonialism and called for radical change. I mean, the empty words that most politicians speak about guaranteeing the rights of Indigenous people don't mean much when the fundamental oppressive relationships of settler colonialism remain intact. And you have Indigenous people still marginalized on reservations and still oppressed by the Indian Act and you know, packed into prisons. I mean, society as a whole needs to be restructured for genuine decolonization to be achieved. It's not impossible, but for such revolutionary change to happen, all the peoples of this land have to want something more. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me. Jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and leap on me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me, materialists test me, pollution it chokes me, movies they joke me, politicians exploit me, city life that jades me, Hudson Bay fleece me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
Thank you.
when your mother cries and you ask God why. Greed is the knife and the scars run deep. How many races with much reason to weep and your children cry. Oh, and you ask God why. Annie, she came from the lavender. Killed a family all around, population boom, living in two rooms. Katie, she came from downtown 10th Street, then in a bed and no shoes on their feet. 1916 came, they played the Patriots game. Freddie, he came from the Ivy Flats, tenement slums and infested with rats, sleeping on damp straw, trying not to break the law. Thomas, he came from Kilmaine in Mayo. Semi-starvation was the only life you saw in a two-room shack, then jailed and let off rack. Children cry, oh, and you ask God why. I look to the east, I look to the west, to the north and the south, and I'm not too impressed. Time after crime, they rape, rob, pillaged, enslaved, and murdered. Jesus Christ was their God, and they done it in his name, so he could take the blame if it's not all a game. With Bible in one hand and a sword in the other, they came to purify my land and my Gaelic Irish mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers. With their own ancient customs, laws, music, art, way of life and culture, tribal in structure, we had a civilization when they were still not under our nations. We suffer with the Native American, Indian in Asia, Aboriginal Australia, the African people with their history so deep, and our children still weep, and our lives are still cheap. You came from Germany, from France, from England and from Spain, from Belgium and from Portugal, you are the much the same. You took what was not yours, went against your own Bible. You broke your own laws just to outdo the rival. But did you ever apologize for the hundreds of millions of lives you destroyed and terrorized? Or have you never realized? Did you never feel shame for what was done in your country's name? I'm pointing out who's to blame. I'm pointing out so inhumane. I'm still to teach you in your school about those glorious days of rule and how it's your destiny to be superior to me. But if you've any kind of mind, you'll see that all humankind are the children of this earth, and your hate for them will chew you up and spit you out. You'll never kill, I will to be free, to be free.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We heard a couple of songs there. The first was by the Mi'kmaq singer-songwriter Willie Dunn, I Pity the Country. He did that song in the 1970s, and then we have a more modern song, though I think he did it in the 1990s, which actually is a pretty decent time ago now, by Damien Dempsey, Irish singer-songwriter, with the song Colony. And that song is really powerful. Because it's about internationalism. It's about solidarity between oppressed people as they fight for justice, as they fight for liberation. And it's a really important message that is contained in that song. Now, I want to round out the show with as I often do, with a talk by Michael Parenti, because the stuff he talks about in the lectures that he gives, that he's given over the years, really touch on a lot of things that are very relevant to the contemporary struggles that we're involved in for justice for Indigenous people, or justice or anti-colonial struggle here in Canada, or the struggle against capitalism, the workers' struggle, labor struggle, environmental struggle. All these things he really touches on in the talks he gives. So this one particular deals with the media and pushing back against racism in the media, pushing back against sexism in the media, pushing back against anti-worker, pro-capitalist sentiments in the media, and colonial and racist stereotypes, all that kind of stuff. Absolutely relevant to the stuff we're dealing with right now, because that media, of course, is a key plane of struggle as we're going forward, as we're trying to build justice. So I think the contents of this talk are very, very relevant. So I'm gonna play it for you now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse. The talk we're about to hear by Dr. Michael Parenti is titled Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. Michael Parenti is an author and political analyst. Among his books are The Sword and the Dollar, Inventing Reality, History is Mystery, and his latest, The Terrorism Trap. This talk was given in 1989 in North Hollywood, California, during the administration of George Bush I, an administration consisting of most of the same players that occupy positions in the present Bush administration. In the talk, Parenti looks at the entertainment media as a propaganda vehicle for American ruling class interests and attitudes. With the recent spate of war movies and TV shows glorifying the CIA, FBI, and police, this 13-year-old talk is eerily relevant. Control of media is even more concentrated now than 13 years ago, as most major media outlets are subsidiaries of massive corporations with interests in a variety of areas, including armaments. At the time this talk was given, Saddam Hussein was a great friend of the United States, and Osama bin Laden was, in the words of the great communicator Ronald Reagan, the moral equivalent of America's founding fathers.
I want to today give attention to the other side of the media, not the news media, but the entertainment media, because the entertainment media consumes a much larger share of the viewing time of most Americans than do the news programs. And I thought I would call this book something like The Hidden Political Images of the Entertainment Media. And then as I thought about it, I said, well, what's so hidden about it? It's rather blatant. And what I looked at are Hollywood films. That's what I'm studying, Hollywood films and TV dramas, TV miniseries, teleplays, and the like. What I find is a real abundance of images and ideologies, ones that are essentially supportive of imperialism, anti-communism, capitalism, racism, sexism, militarism, say militarism twice, militarism, authoritarian violence, vigilantism, and anti-working class attitudes. More specifically, I found these kinds of themes. Individual heroics predominate over collective action. There's almost no collective action. There's almost no story or drama where the people organize together and do something for themselves. I mean, there are one or two exceptions. When they do, when there is collective action, they're usually led by some hero who has to spur them on and really do the whole thing himself. Free enterprise is the best economic system in the world. That's a message which is not necessarily telegraphed so much as it is presumed. Certainly, there's nothing positive ever uttered about alternative systems in the entertainment media. Private monetary gain is a central and worthy objective of life, although those who are too wickedly greedy, the Dynasty guys and Dallas fellows, they can meet with disapproval. Sometimes business characters are insensitive to other people's needs because they're so busy with their business activities, but when properly apprised of the problems and such, they are suddenly capable of legendary acts of generosity, which I've never seen in real life, but I see on television dramas say, the kid needs the house, give it to him. They give him to give it to, I'll give the factory to Joe, he's a good guy, and all that sort of thing. Workers are beer guzzling, regular Joes, I mean, good natured and all that, but really not very bright, incapable. If I was to say any one consistent stereotype I've seen about how blue collar people are portrayed in the media, with the exception of certain films, by the way, everything I say, there are a few notable exceptions, with the exception of a film like Silkwood or A Matter of Sex, a few others, they're almost always incapable of leadership and of acting as agents of their own lives. One wonders really where labor unions came from. Labor unions are always up to not much good. They're rather insensitive to the needs of workers. Some years back, there was a TV program, Archie Bunker, All in the Family, which was supposedly against various forms of bigotry. And while it came out against the bigot, who was Archie Bunker, and made a little message statement against bigotry, every program practiced a bigotry of its own by portraying the working person as this goof and goon, and one of the big laugh lines in All in the Family was when Archie Bunker mispronounced a word, committed a malapropism, and the canned laughter would come on. That's not funny. There's nothing funny when somebody mispronounces a word. I mean, all you're saying is that he hasn't had the opportunity to have the education that some other people have had. But class bigotry is a very common form of bigotry, and it remains totally unchallenged, unlike gender bigotry or race bigotry, which at least is challenged today. The practices and forms of class bigotry go on in abundance in the media and remain unchallenged. Affluent professionals in almost all programs are considered much more interesting than blue-collar or ordinary service workers. There are many more of them as principal characters. Women and ethnic minorities are really not as capable, effective, or interesting as white males. Cop shows, the police and everyone else should be given a freer hand in combating the large criminal element in America, using generous applications of force and violence without too much attention to constitutional rights. In fact, in any number of cop shows, the cop will get up and talk about that Constitution isn't going to protect you, it's only me with my gun and the hell with the Constitution. The ills of society are caused by individual malfactors and not by anything in the socioeconomic system. No, no, no. There are some unworthy persons in our established institutions, but they are eventually dealt with and set straight for the most part. U.S. military force is directed only toward laudable goals, or more often the goals are not even stated. It's just assumed that we've got to win this one. Nothing said about what kind of interests are involved. I mean, after all, why are people doing all this fighting and killing? It's a question that remains largely unstated. Western industrial and military might, especially the U.S.'s, has been a civilizing force for the benefit of backward peoples throughout the Third World. The United States and the entire Western world have long been threatened from abroad by foreign aggressors, such as the Russians, communist terrorists, Arab terrorists, and generally the swarthy hordes of less developed peoples. Those are, I would say, some of the general themes that come up again and again in any number of movies. And the last one is the one I want to focus on today. It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, first enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages, They can be Indians, they could be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle, and the human beings know what to do. They level their guns, and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest as they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers. This is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now, the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that. And then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, 1 million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train. Now, once you kill, and once you plunder like that, once you go in to take another people's land and steal their labor and enslave their labor and take their resources and preempt and take over their markets, once you do that kind of act, and it wasn't the ordinary people of Europe and North America that did it, it was the ruling interest that did it, and they used our taxes, our money, and our sons to go fight. But once you do that, you have to do two other things ideologically and psychologically. One, you have to deny the humanity of your victims. They are subhumans and they are moral inferiors. As John Wayne said in one of his horse operas in 1953, he said, "There's humans and then there's Comanches." A very clear message. He couldn't have said it better. There's humans and then there's Comanches. You're not killing human beings. You're killing these wild animals. By the way, you can get the same quotes from Winston Churchill about the Afghanis. You can get the same quotes from George Washington about American Indians. And you can get them from any number of imperialists. The second thing you do is you must ascribe all your crimes to them. You deny your own inhumanity and you accuse your victims of doing to you what you have been doing to them all along. Sometimes imperialism can take on an endearing, tender note, though. I found one movie which I want to share with you. It was with little, cutesy, adorable Shirley Temple. She was in the movie called, ready for this, Wee Willie Winkie, 1937. And she asked her grandfather, who's the British colonel. They're off there, way out in some place where the British have no business being. And she says, "Why are you mad at Khoda Khan, leader of the, quote, warlike tribes?" The British colonel answers tenderly, "Oh, darling, We're not mad at Kota Khan. England wants to be friends with all her peoples. But if we don't shoot him, he'll shoot us. This is sort of the Pat Buchanan, Cap Weinberger approach to foreign policy. Now, another interesting thing, these defamatory stereotypes and images demonstrate the unholy marriage between imperialism and racism. Marx has a very fascinating quote. I've got it in The Sword and the Dollar. Of British officers in the Sepoy Rebellion in India. It was a contemporary account. The officers said, we hanged every nigger we found. In India, they're talking about India. Use the term nigger. We hanged every nigger we found. And every Indian they came across, they hanged them. The suppression was horrible. In South Africa, the people are called Kaffirs. In the Middle East, ragheads. In Asia, slopes and gooks. Well, these terms, nigger, Kaffir, slopes, gooks, this is a vocabulary of imperialism as well as a vocabulary of racism. And indeed, I'm not going to argue that imperialism is the cause of racism, but certainly imperialism is one of the biggest instigators and propagators of it. You have to finally define whole categories of people as different and inferior to justify what you're doing. Even when the imperialism is not of the violent sort, and even when the racism is not evident, it still can permeate a film sort of implicitly. Take the case of how Hollywood has dealt with Africa. The Tarzan movies, I won't even say a word. There, it's so evident and so obvious. We'll just say the Tarzan movies. Okay, I've proven my case. But let's go on. Let's go on beyond Tarzan, and let's take a more modern-day effort, finally. Finally, Hollywood, finally, in the 1980s, in the last 30 years, I've been waiting for an intelligent movie about Africa. There's 1,000 stories in Africa. There are stories of tribal conflicts, of generational conflicts, of urbanization, of cultural change, of labor struggle, horrendous, incredible level of labor struggle like nothing you see in North America, like nothing you see in Europe. 250,000 gold miners out on strike together, and they don't have computers and carpools and all that sort of thing. Incredible amount of discipline and organization and courage from a people who supposedly are not ready for self-government. 1,000 stories, 1,000 dramas that you can make. And so Hollywood finally makes a movie about Africa, and it's called Out of Africa. And what's it about? It's about an upper crust Danish literati whose major concern, it seems, is to hang on to her plantation and get it together with her beautiful blonde boyfriend, Robert Redford. That's what the story was about, played by Meryl Streep. And the Africans in Out of Africa, I kept looking for the Africans. And there they were, sort of around the edges, saying things like, is Sahib happy? Does Sahib want dinner now? May I do this for Sahib? Addressing her reverently. And then Robert Redford comes along and he sets her straight, because he's kind of gone native a little, you know, and he says, I want to show you my Africa, the real Africa. I said, hey, here it comes, the breakthrough. And what does he do? He takes her up in the plane, and you see those same old aerial shots straight out of the Tarzan flicks of the zebra herds and the giraffes running along. Still no Africans. And I said, ah, oh, this is why they named it Out of Africa, because there's nothing in Africa about it. Then finally we got to a really good film, and I do mean it, Gandhi, which at least portrayed Indian principles and showed the Indians acting with courage together, although it all came from the magic leadership of Mohandas Gandhi, apparently. And it even showed some of the brutality of the British. But even that film, I would have to make a serious criticism, because it gets to the heart of the political economy of the entertainment media. And that is that the political economy of imperialism was never shown in that otherwise fine film. The forced underdevelopment and impoverishment of India by British capitalism was never shown. The fact that when the British went into India between 1830 and 1900, the per capita earnings of the Indians dropped by two-thirds. That India was pillaged. That poverty was not an original condition of India. India is a lush, fertile subcontinent. The poverty of India is a direct cause of the policies of British imperialism, which was to forcibly deindustrialize India. That could have been dealt with in some way. You know, you could say, well, you know, I mean, what do you want, Parenti? How can you do that in a film? I mean, you can't start reading tracks of Lenin in the middle of a film or chapter 3 from The Sword and the Dollar, you know, you just can't do that. But during the course of a movie, you can have some discussion, some word explaining what are the British doing in India. I sat for 3.5 hours through that film, and they never explain why are the British in India? What are they doing there? And you're left with the impression that they're in India simply because they like to strut about with their swagger sticks, and they simply don't have the decency to go home when asked to go home. But in fact, very powerful British interests got very rich off the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets of India. A film that really deals in an uncompromising way, and in a very good way, it's not a particularly well-made film, but the script and the political content of it is terrific, was made in 1969. It deals with imperialism, the political economy of imperialism, too, and that was called Burn, an Italian-French production. It's nice to hear applause from the 7 people who were able to see that movie, because the distribution of that movie was remarkable. I mean, it actually dealt with the class interest behind it, dealt with the transition from slavery to free labor. You had Marlon Brando explaining why it'd be better, it would have less costs and all that sort of thing. This movie was suppressed in its distribution. It was taken out of circulation. It did not reach many theaters, and it did not stay long in the ones it did reach. And it would make a nice little story as to what happened to the distribution of that movie. There's another area where the wagon train paradigm exists, and that's right in the urban frontier. It's what Hal Himmelstein in his book on television calls the urban frontier. It's the fort, the wagon train, the encampment all over again, but it's in the middle of the city. Again, you've got the human beings, and they are under siege, and they are under siege again from swarthy hordes. There are plenty of TV shows, as you know, and plenty of movies. Let me just give you one called Cobra by Sylvester Stallone, who wrote it and acted in it. The comedian Jay Leno was right. Stars like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone deserve a lot of credit for opening up the acting profession to a lot of people who could not get into it back when speech was a requirement. Cobra is, and by the way, this has been a standard character over the last 20 years, in the last 15 years or so, in films and TV series. He's a whacked out Vietnam vet, bitter, wounded, angry that he couldn't win it. He wanted to win it, and you didn't let him win it. So now he's a detective in New York, and he fights the whole gang, and they are trying to terrorize and take over the city or the country or the world. It's not clear. And so it's cowboy versus Indians, cowboy singular, cowboy versus Indians. And Cobra goes out there, and again, the same thing, makes his talks about you pussyfooting with the Constitution and all these rights, and I'm going to do it my way, and I'll really take care of them. And Cobra doesn't believe in sissy things like arrest, trial, and incarceration. He just executes these guys. He just murders people, and one of the gang guys he captures, he douses him with gasoline, and then he lights a match. As he sets fire to the guy, he sneeringly says, "You have the right to remain silent." Now, the most durable version of the swarthy hordes, that external alien menace that's going to come at us, is the red tide and the red menace. You can defeat the Indians and the Bushmen, but communism is still around there, and it will subvert us from within, or it will inundate us from without. You remember Ronald Reagan's speech about Nicaragua? If we don't stop them in Nicaragua, the red tide will be lapping at our borders. That Nicaragua is only 12 hours drive from Brownsville, Texas. That's if you drive 180 miles an hour, but whatever.